Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Poker Hall of Famer Billy Baxter, in which I hope is his first appearance of many on the show. We'll be talking to Billy in a moment. We regularly talk about asset forfeiture on the show, where the police stop people on the highway and confiscate money without there being any evidence of a crime. This past week, United States Attorney General Eric Holder said that police could no longer use federal law to do this. They still have state laws allowing civil forfeiture, so I'm not positive how much good this will do, but it's a step in the right direction. Richard, what did you think about this?
Yeah, it was great news. I mean, really welcome news. But yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out. I mean, you're right. It's really a step in the right direction, but we'll have to see what happens.
All right. We received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Seems some guy's a blackjack player and won $5,000 in free play. He has to play that off on machines. He doesn't know anything about video poker, but he's heard that video poker has the best odds, so he wanted a few pointers from me on which game to play and how to play the hands. My response was to forget about it. Yes, playing video poker over video blackjack might save a couple percent, which means $100 on $5,000 of free play. It's going to take him considerable time and energy to learn video poker, and if he's only going to be using it for this one little time, it isn't worth it. He might end up with a W2G or two, and if you're not used to those, that's not a trivial matter. So my recommendation to him was that he play video blackjack or some other game that he knows. And so it's just not worth it to do it. So what did you think about that, Richard?
Yeah, it's definitely not worth trying to learn video poker. The best game would probably be if they have a craps machine that lets you take odds. You know, your expected loss would be a lot less than a video blackjack machine. I thought it was interesting that he at one point mentioned that somebody had offered him $4,000 for the $5,000 in free play, and asked if you thought he should do that. I would like to just say to him, I will give you $4,100 for the $5,000 in free play, assuming that it's negotiable.
And it's not in Massachusetts or something.
Well, yeah, if it's in Vegas, but. You know, I think there's as crazy as that sounds to us for someone to be willing to sell $5,000 for $4,000. You know, people are really risk averse, and for those people, I think there's money to be made for people like us who are not risk averse.
So you'll buy the variance.
I'll buy the variance. Absolutely.
So you're an insurance company with a healthy premium, and you figure to do all right on that.
Yep. That would be my thought. So if he's listening, yeah, I'll offer $4,100.
My guess is that Billy would take insurance on Billy would offer insurance for people who are risk averse too. So let's talk to Billy. He was born and raised in Georgia, and through the years has been a champion at shooting marbles, a pool hustler, a poker player, a gin rummy player, a bookie, a casino owner, a golf hustler, a very knowledgeable sports bettor, and a boxing trainer. among other things. And he has great stories going back decades about each of these things. He has 7 World Series of Poker bracelets and was inducted into the Poker Hall of Fame in 2006. Billy Baxter, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, it's nice to be here. How y'all doing this morning?
We're doing good. Our audience is largely professional gamblers and want to be professional gamblers. Tax-wise, we all owe Billy a big debt of gratitude. More than 30 years ago, he won a court case against the IRS that changed the way gambling winnings were taxed. Tell us about this, Billy.
Well, you know, basically what happened that, in the early, late 70s, really, when I came to Vegas, right off the bat, I got to winning a lot of poker tournaments, and it ran into quite a bit of money. And naturally, I was paying tax on this money. And at that time, believe it or not, taxes were 50%, which was more than they've ever been. And I paid my 50% tax on the winnings that I had. And about 2 or 3 years into this process, I guess, the government came in on me. It was not a criminal matter. It was a civil matter. And they said that, you know, that gambling income was, this was not earned income, and that I owed another 20% on this money. They said that, you know, it's just like putting a, they were trying to compare me to somebody putting a dollar on a slot machine and $1 million falls out, which would be unearned income. And so
Not to me, it wouldn't.
Yeah. So anyway, they, I went to my accountant and he says, you know, if you don't win these things with the government, penalties and interest, you'll wind up paying the rest of your life. I recommend you just pay the 20%, and then we'll sue them for a return of the money. So that's what we did. We paid the money under protest, and then we sued the IRS for a return of the money. And the story gets kind of interesting from there. We go to Reno. It was the first court that we're in, and the judge, he's listening to the government. Now, this is not like a criminal case. I wasn't even there. But anyway, the people for the government that handled their case, they said, well, you know, it's gambling. We all know what it is. Just luck. You put a dollar on a slot machine, $1 million falls out and you're one of the lucky ones. You walk out with the money. Well, this money has to be taxed at 70%. So anyway, the lawyer that handled the case for me, he listened to all that and he says, well, you know, we just don't get it. So Mr. Baxter, like Jack Nicklaus, enters a golf tournament. He wins the golf tournament. He pays 50%, and that's earned income. He spends all his time practicing all. Mr. Baxter's wife, Mr. Baxter tells me, she complains all the time, but he works all the time. He's never home. He's always playing poker, sometimes 2 or 3 days at a time. And yet y'all are basically saying that he doesn't work for this money. When Jack Nicklaus wins his tournament, he pays 50%. When Mr. Baxter wins a poker tournament or whatever, and y'all say it's not earned income and you want 70% from him. It doesn't make sense because poker is obviously a game of skill. And anyway, when the judge heard everybody's arguments and all, when he got through, the judge says, and I never will forget the words he used, he says, well, I'd like to say just one thing to the government. He says, I find y'all's argument to be ludicrous. I'm not even sure I know what that word means, but anyway, I remembered it from their arguments. And he says, I just wish, he's talking to the guy that's handling the case, he says, I just wish you had some money, maybe $20,000 or something, and could sit down and play Mr. Baxter some poker and just see just how long you would last. He said, I don't think you'd last very long. I think you might be a little bit outskilled here. He says, I'm throwing this whole thing out of here. So he threw the case out. But they didn't give up. They appealed it to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in California. We go over there. Same thing happens. Boom, they throw it out, throw the case out. Now they threaten to take it to the United States Supreme Court, the government does. And so they called, but basically I think they were just wanting to make a deal at this point. And so we said, well, you know what, we've paid our taxes, we stand by our position, and let's go to the Supreme Court. We're ready to go. So they said, well, let me ask you this. Would you give up half of the money? I says, we wouldn't give up a dollar. I says, we're just going to go to the Supreme Court. I'm real interested to see what they'd have to say about this anyway. And a month or two later, we get a letter that they have dropped the case. And it's in the law books now. It's William E. Baxter Jr. versus the United States of America. And they cite it in a lot of different gambling cases. But that was the end of that case.
So now we can have gambling as a profession. We can write off gambling expenses, tournament entry fees, travel expenses, those kind of things.
That's correct.
That's for
we all owe you a big debt of gratitude.
We do.
Because most of our listeners are filing, a lot of our listeners are filing professional gambler status.
Right. So, sure.
Yeah.
Now, when you moved to Vegas in the early 70s, you found two gold mines, so to speak, named Major Riddle and Sid Wyman. Tell us about these guys.
Boy, you're talking about two of the great gambling legends of all time. You know, we have these casinos now, and they're owned by corporations and that sort of thing, and not one of them will give – they won't even – comp a meal for you hardly anymore unless you're some big player and all. It's not like it was years ago. But Sid Wyman and Major Riddle were the owners of the Dunes, or two of the owners of the Dunes Hotel, which is where the Bellagio is now.
Uh-huh.
And by owning a casino, I came to the conclusion that they fancied themselves to be gamblers when, in fact, they were pretty bad.
Yeah.
And they loved to play poker. So now, I had been in the gambling business and so forth in Georgia, but the reason I moved out here was it was illegal in Georgia, so I got tired of having the doors broke down, so I decided to move to Las Vegas. And we started playing poker, and they liked this game called Deuce to Seven, No Limit. I never had even played it. And they played with a $500 ante, $1,002 blind. This was back in the 70s, which is probably the biggest game there's ever been, I guess. I wouldn't say that now. It's once Andy Bill came along, but because he's played some really big games. But compared to, let's say, a $4,000 and $8,000 game at the Bellagio, at that time, based on what money's worth now and what it was worth then, I'd say the No Limit Deuce 7 was probably the biggest game there ever was.
Now, this is a draw game.
It's a draw low ball game.
And so aces are considered high.
That's correct.
And straights and flushes kill you.
They do. And all cards are concealed, and you can bet all your money anytime. There's no limit. We played No Limit. And they were some of the most, in my opinion, courageous gamblers there ever was that played in that game. One guy, he's in the Poker Hall of Fame. His name was Fred Ferris. They called him Sarge. I think he was the gutsiest player I ever played with, and I played with some really good ones like Doyle and all the rest, Johnny Moss. But Fred was a special gambler. He put all his money on the table all the time, and he wasn't afraid to go home broke. He was a real gambler. And but anyway, we had Sarge, and there was Doyle, and, of course, Jimmy Chagra came along during that period of time, and different people, Chip Reese came in on the tail end of that play.
He's younger.
Oh, and Bobby Baldwin was one of our regulars at the time. He had just come out here, and at the time he wasn't working. He was a professional gambler and a very good player in addition to that.
So when Major Riddle or Sid would come sit down in the game, what would they buy in for?
Usually anywhere from never less than 50. Most of the time they'd buy in 100. And, you know, you'd sit with 100, and then gradually, by the end of the evening, a lot of people would have 500,000, 600,000, 800,000 in front of them. I mean, that was just common occurrence. You know, and Major lose 100, and he'd order 200. And if he lose that, he'd order a rack with 500. And so, you know, money was they owned the casinos. They just would go get them another rack.
Wow.
And you were saying that Major, he liked you as a player. He didn't like the other guys because
I wasn't the only one. One thing I discovered very early on with him was you couldn't quit. In other words, he had a lot of board meetings and different things he was on. He might leave at 12 o'clock to go to a bank board meeting and tell you I'll be back in 2 hours, and 8, 9 o'clock that night, he'd leave his chips on the table. And if you ever quit and left, he'd get mad with you. I learned that he didn't like people that left. Like he said, what was that guy's name that left? I don't want to play with him anymore. That sort of thing. So he was quite a man, and he wanted you to be waiting on him when he come back. So I've sat there all night many a time with cold rags on my neck just trying to stay awake till he'd come back. Sometime he'd come back. Sometime he wouldn't come back at all. Finally, after 2 or 3 days, you had the right to leave.
Oh, that's the rule. After 2 days, you can leave. Okay, now, you mentioned Jimmy Chagra.
Right.
I've heard stories that he probably lost more money in the 70s in Vegas than anybody else. I'm not sure that's true.
I couldn't argue with that.
And so he also played golf.
Yes, he did. He loved golf.
So
he didn't play very well, but he played.
So there was one story I heard is you beat him over $300,000 and it took some special effort to collect the money. What was that about?
Well, at that time, everybody was out there betting on the side. I'll tell you, I'll lead into that story just to show you how this was a gambler from around town. His name was Tommy Fisher. And Tommy Fisher's dead now, but he could shoot in the low 70s with no problem. And so I staked Tommy to play this guy. We were playing like, I think I was betting a $10,000 Nassau on Tommy and maybe 10 or 20 on somebody else or whatever. Tommy didn't want to put up any of his own money. So I give him a 20% free roll to play. And the first day, we won a lot of money, and Tommy got his money. I said, well, Tommy, don't you think y'all just bet $5,000 yourself? I mean, why should you? He said, trust me, Billy, this guy's going to turn out to be a golf hustler. I can spot him a mile away. So anyway, as it turns out, later on, I'll get ahead of the story. He could have never beaten anybody. He was probably about a 90 shooter, and he was playing with nobody in the game and he was playing with could shoot under 80. I mean, it couldn't shoot 80 or better. Doyle was in the game. Doyle might have had the highest handicap of anybody in the game, and he could shoot about 76. It's pretty hard to beat a 90 shooter when you shoot 76.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty hard to beat him without trying to hit a few in the water anyway. But getting back to Chagra, he was special. That's all I can say. As it turned out, none of us knew he was a drug dealer. Nobody knew that. He wanted to play poker. But it turned out it seemed like he was trying to pass himself off as a gambler and act like he was winning or whatever, because I guess he had money he wanted to launder or whatever he wanted to do. But like I said, he just showed up in Vegas. We did a little background check on him. His brother was one of the most prominent attorneys in El Paso, Texas. He come from a very wealthy family, supposedly, and really nice looking guy that, he seemed like a gentle enough guy, to be honest. But anyway, getting back to the golf, we playing golf, and everybody in the world was trying to bet. Tony Spilotro, just everybody. And so every night he would meet everybody at the horseshoe and straighten up, pay off. And then he liked to shoot dice. Funny thing, he got on a hot streak. He would pay off maybe $400,000 or $500,000 for that day. And then he'd go shoot dice and he'd win back $400,000 or $500,000 every night. He had Jack Benyon crazy. I mean, Jack Benyon was coming to the golf course every day trying to bet on the side and all. So anyway, the story you're wanting me to tell you about is the time I wound up winning like 300 and something thousand, maybe 320 or something like that. And he told me, he says, when he left to go, I'm not going to the horseshoe tonight. If you want to come get your money, you come to my house. I said, well, I don't know where you live. So he gave me an address. So I go over to his house. And that's the first time that I felt like, gee, you know what? This guy has something bad wrong here. This guy, I wasn't stupid. I said, you know, I believe this guy's a drug dealer. He had two guys walking around in the front yard with, like, carbine rifles.
Oh, that could give you a clue.
Yeah, that was a little clue. So anyway, I go in, And as soon as I go in the house, there's a pool table there. Well, when I was young, I was a pretty good player. And so I didn't know that I, until he asked me to play, he says, well, you got to give me a chance to get some of this money back. We'll play a little nine ball. And at that point, I said, well, maybe I have died and gone to heaven here. So I said, you know, he'll have to be pretty good to beat me, although I hadn't played in years. So anyway, I said, what are we going to play for? I said, $5,000, all right? He said, no, no, you got me stuck all this money. We've been bet $20,000 a game. So I said to myself, I said, well, maybe he can play a little bit then. So I said, okay, you got it, let's go. Because, I mean, I had a 320 head start, so I wasn't really worried about losing any money. Maybe I'd lose 100 if he could beat me. I'd just quit. So anyway, right from game one, I knew he was either stalling or he couldn't play. He couldn't make a ball. So I never tried to make one ball from game one. In fact, the whole session, I don't think I ever made over two balls in a row. I just tried to luck the nine ball every deal. And so about into the session, I had gotten about 200,000 winner on the pool, you know, like 10 games. And those guys that work for him come inside, and they says, hey, boss, what are we going to do about this guy?
These are the guys with the carbine rifles.
These are the guys with the carbine rifles. Uh-huh. And he says, I don't know, but if I don't start winning some games pretty soon, I don't know what's liable to happen around here.
Uh-huh.
So
that's another clue.
Yeah, it was. So I said to myself, I said, well, you know, that money you owed me was a pretty good bit. I said, you know, maybe I should lose some of these games back. So I just refused to make the nine ball from that point on. I mean, I had to leave it hanging in the hole, everything. But anyway, he gets back within three games, and I said, Jimmy, I got to get on home. I told my wife, I wanted to make sure he knew. I said, I told my wife I was coming over to your house. I was thinking then, I said, well, I want to make sure you don't kill me. So he said, no, you got to play a little longer. So anyway, I lose back the other three games. So now I'm even with the pool. I said, Jimmy, that's it. I have got to go. So he says, God damn it. Every time I'm just beginning to get to shooting good and you're going to quit. He still ain't made over one ball, I don't think, in a row. So he says, oh, go get the guy's money. Bring him his money. He didn't say it that nice, but I guess we're on the radio. So
yeah, we're on AM radio.
Yeah, so I leave out the vulgarity. And so anyway, they bring me out the money. And this is when I finally knew for sure this guy, it was like three shopping bags full of money. I mean, like I had to make two trips to the car. And $330,000, you know, it ain't all that much if it's hundreds. But it's a lot if it's 20s.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, the wind up of the golf, though, is a few days later, you know, there's always somebody that that kills the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak. So we're all playing golf, and now it's like a piranha pool out there. There's so many people out there trying to bet and all. And so we're playing, and Puggy Pearson's in, and he's been in the matches all along. But anyway, he gets down there in the woods or something, and he kicks his ball out of the bushes. And one of them bodyguards or shoggers sees it.
Blatant cheating.
Yeah, blatant cheating. So he runs over to Jimmy and says, Jimmy, Puggy just kicked his ball out. So he says, that's it. You guys, I'm not losing another dollar. He was looking for an excuse to quit. He was already losing anyway. So I never will forget it. Doyle drives down there in the golf cart to where Puggy is. And he says, Puggy, what in the world are you doing? How could you do something like that? And Puggy just looked up to him, and he says, Doyle, I just couldn't help myself.
If there's an advantage to be taken, he was going to take it.
That was Puggy.
Uh-huh. I bet he did that at poker, too.
Well,
that's another story.
That's another story for another day.
Okay. You went to prison for about 10 months because gambling wasn't legal in Georgia.
That's correct.
And so before you went, you made $5,000 bets with Doyle and another $5,000 bets with Jack Binion that you'd lose 40 pounds.
No, it was worse than that. No, that's right. It was 40. I weighed 205, and I bet I'd get down to 165. You got the story better than me. That's right.
And
you must not have been that confident if you were only betting 5,000.
Well, no, that's just kind of, it was just kind of a complimentary thing. They actually knew something that I didn't know, that it's not that easy to lose weight in prison with the food that they feed you.
I'll bet.
I had a trick for them once I got there. Once I realized that, I didn't lose a pound the first 2 months I was there. But anyway, go ahead with you.
It's your story. You should tell
us
what happened.
So we actually want to tell us the story.
Okay, so I'll tell you about what happened. And so I had a place in Georgia. We had craps, roulette, blackjack, just like Las Vegas. And during the I was from Augusta, Georgia. During the Masters golf tournament, the place got raided, and I wound up getting a year in jail for this. So that's
now. What year was this?
This was it happened around 1969 or 70. It stayed in court for about 2 years, and then I was sentenced. I moved out here, and I thought maybe I could get out of it, but they kept wanting me to come back, and so I had a federal bookmaking case pending also. So the government allowed me to plead guilty and they run the two cases concurrently, and I was able to do the time in Georgia in my hometown, in the state. So anyway, I go back with this bet, and I get a good job. I had a lot of help there because I was from my hometown. I got to be in what they call an honor barracks, which is where all the best prisoners were. That didn't mean they. When I say best prisoners, I mean people that were closest to getting out. They might have been murderers and whatever, but they had 2 or 3 years or a year or so to go, and they were trying to behave. So they over there in the prison, a guy might be in there for drinking too much, and he might want to cut your head off because he got a big sentence or whatever he had. So there was just two different kind of prisoners. Anyway, they gave me a job in the parts department, which is where the trucks would go up. This was a real chain gang I was on, incidentally. This was a Georgia chain gang. They put them on the bus every day. You go out on the side of the road. They got the dogs at one end. Two guys, it was called a shotgun gang. Had two guards, both of them with shotguns. They'd be working with the swing blades, and they got the bloodhounds ready to go get them if they get too hot and run.
Just like Cool Hand Luke.
That's exactly it. I was on Tobacco Road, which is the name of the street that prison was on. Tobacco Road in Augusta, Georgia. So anyway, I wasn't out there on the chain gang, but I was down in the parts department issuing parts. But you stayed on your feet all day, and you couldn't do any it's just, you're just there. So at night, there was a guy that slept in the bunk next to me. I remember his name was Herbert Lee, and he was in there for killing his wife and her parents. And he was what they call the house man. And the house man's job was to mop the floors in the morning. Now, there's only 30 prisoners in this barracks here. Mop the floors, clean the bathrooms, and then at night, and then you were free all day. And then at night when the prisoners come in, you would take orders and you'd go around to the main maximum security prison and buy them candy bars or coke, whatever they order. You know, you had a list, and that was your job. So this was Herbert Lee's job, and he says, you know, I really would love to be the inmate chaplain.
Uh-huh.
Once they get in jail, you know, they want to get religion because that helps them get out a little sooner. So anyway, at least they think they do. So anyway, I went to see the warden one day. And I says, you know, Herbert Lee wants to be the inmate chaplain. And I says, you know, I'll just be honest with you why I'm here. I made a bet with two gentlemen in Las Vegas, $10,000 before I came here, that I would lose 40 pounds. I hadn't lost a pound. I said, but I watched Herbert Lee's job, what it is, after he gets through. It's about 2 hours, a little work in the morning. I mean, I could ask. They have a big outside area where you could run or anything with a fence around it and everything, the barbed wire and all, but it was open compared. The other prison was locked down. So, and they had weights out in the yard. They had everything out there. I said, if I could watch what I'm eating a little better and exercise and all, I believe if I had his job, and he wants to be the inmate chaplain, I believe I'd win that bet. And I'd be willing to give that $10,000 to the prison to fix that barracks up and all over there.
Ah.
So anyway, He said, well, no, we don't need that money for that. He says, we got plenty of money to fix that place up with. He said, but, you know, Herbert Lee wants to be the inmate chaplain. We might can arrange that. So now the next day, I'm down at the parks department. They get a call and they say, send Baxter up to the warden's office. So I go up to the warden's office and he says, well, you now the house man.
Well,
so
good.
That's your new job. So now I start, you mop in the morning. So that was really good for this. You know, I do that, mop the barracks. It was a long barracks too. Like 30 people slept down through there. And that was good for, so then I'd go outside and I work out a little bit with the weights. Then I got to slowly running. I got up to, I could run 3 miles before I got out.
Wow.
And from not exercising at all, that was quite a bit.
Yes, it is.
So I'll speed on through the story. I get out. The day I get out, my wife had been pregnant with our first child while I was in prison. She was there in town. We flew back to Las Vegas, and I went straight to the Horseshoe. I met Doyle and Jack Binion, and they got a meat scale that they weighed their meat on at the Horseshoe. And I got up on the scale, and they said, William Baxter, 162 pounds. Uh-huh. So I was 3 pounds under the weight. So I wasn't the bad anyway.
What did you wear for the weigh-in? I would think that.
Well, I didn't have to strip. I just got down to my shorts, and it was an easy wear. I already knew I didn't weigh myself 50 times in the last 3 days, you know. So, I mean, I knew I was well under. There was no, and I made sure what I ate the night. There was no, and then I weighed before I left.
So, I know Doyle has made lots and lots of weight bets over the
years. He's lost more money on weight bets than anybody. I mean, he's sadistic with what he loves to make weight bets.
Has he ever won?
He
one
won
of them?
One out of the whole bunch, but he's lost a lot of them. I'd venture to say he still loses, but he won one time for about $100,000. But he's made so many weight, and Chip, him and Chip were known for making weight bets.
I heard one time that he had a bet where he was threatening to have his leg cut off to win the bet. But
yeah, he might have. I don't know. He don't like to lose. I know that.
Sports betting is one of your passions now. So what games do you like to bet?
Well, you know, actually, I've always been very active in sports. Between sports and poker, I'm back and forth and all. And I never realized the importance of winning bracelets and all back when they were a lot easier to win. A lot of times during the World Series, I wouldn't even go down there during the World Series. I only would play the low ball events because I didn't want to support Hold'em because I didn't want to get that started. We had a game at the Dunes playing low ball that I was doing real well at, so Doyle always wanted to get a Hold'em game going, so I would knock the Hold'em. I wouldn't even go down there and play. But anyway, I got involved betting sport, but I think my favorite thing is betting the football game once it reaches the halftime. I think there's a better advantage for the player at the half than it is before the game starts. And that's just my personal preference. I bet the games before they start, every other kind of way. But I think I've been more successful all through the years with the games at the halftime than I have before they started.
Do you bet basketball and baseball and that?
You know, when I used to bet everything. Football, basketball, baseball, never took a season off. The last 5 years, I only do football. And I like to do the NCAA tournament. And I'll just watch the games and then bet at the half, so to speak. But I'm phasing out of that. It's just too much work, and I actually enjoy playing poker more than I do betting sports now. It's kind of like going to the golf course. You know, you're out with the guys, and as long as you got a good crowd to play with.
Now, you and Doyle both have pretty big reputations for making money at golf. Which of the two of you is, if you guys are out together, which one should I bet on?
Bet on Doyle. Doyle, I was never a real good golfer. I was a good putter and chipper and all and good at matching up, which is probably the quality you need to be good at. But it really didn't make that much difference what you shoot as long as you win. know, if you shoot 107 and you walk off with the money, that's all that's necessary. Of course, I didn't quite shoot 107, but anyway, I wasn't a real good player. But I played a lot of big game big golf, and I was partners with Doyle a lot. We won some big money playing golf together. But Doyle, he's for his ability and all, I have to give it to him. He probably plays as good for his money as anybody that ever played golf.
Mm. Now, the Super Bowl's coming up. I'm sure our listeners are wondering who you got, who you like.
Well, I'm going to tell you that. I made a bet last summer. I was playing poker in San Diego, and at the time, Seattle had just won the Super Bowl and killed Denver and looked very impressive in doing it. And there was a guy there that wanted to make a bet, and I bet him that I took Seattle and he took Denver for this year to win the Super Bowl. We bet $50,000. And, of course, you know, I got lucky to still be in it yesterday. But his team got knocked out by Indianapolis the week before. So, basically, now I have Seattle. I have a free roll for his $50,000. But I don't really like Seattle in the game. When the line first came out, I took plus three, minus 19 cents, I think it was. And but I could only get down like 20,000 or 25,000.
Plus and three, then, but you bet on the Patriots.
Yes, I bet on the Patriots. Uh-huh. And so I've got kind of a free roll at either winning 30,000 or 20,000. So that's not too bad a shape to be in. But I think I didn't like the way Seattle looked in the game. I didn't like the way they played. And I kind of like New England in the game.
So you actually have a middle if it comes between.
Oh, if it comes in the middle, it'll be nice. And yeah. This game, believe it or not, could be that kind of close game,
sure,
where somebody wins it by one or two.
Yeah.
All right.
Three was not so bad.
We're going to be doing a few commercials, and when we come back, we're going to be asking Billy about his relationship with Stu Unger. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. Players who come in a lot are getting double mailers in January. You pick up your regular mailer amounts Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, and then you get the same amount Friday and Saturday. Do that 3 weeks in a row, and on the fourth week you get an additional double mailer. The new 10-week semester of free video poker classes will begin Wednesday, February 4th at noon in the Grandview Lounge. The first class will be Jacks or Better, and the rest of the schedule is posted on bobdancer.com. At the Palms, the weekly 7 p.m. drawings on Fridays, winners share $10,000. You don't need to be present to win, but you must collect by midnight or your prize evaporates. Five times entries, Friday 8 to midnight. Two times entries Friday between 4 and 6:30. Play for prizes, PFP, through January 30th or up to $190 a day to TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and Home Goods gift cards. Those are all the same cards. They may be redeemed at a rate of 0.2%. You keep your points. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play a lot of games. You sign up for the Gold membership and allows you to get corrections on our games. It is the only place to get corrections on Quick Quads, for example. The game of the week is 100 Play with Super Times Pay. Super Times Pay is a 6-coin per line game where approximately every 15 hands you receive a multiplier in the 2 times to 10 times range. Playing the 6-coin adds about 0.25% to your expected value and does not change your strategy. All right, Billy. Stu Unger, a masterful card player, had some personal problems. You staked him main event in the World Series of Poker probably 3 times. How did that go?
Well, overall it went very good, but I had some good experiences and some bad experiences with Stewie. He had a lot of demons. And one of the things that I had to deal with him was one of the times I was staking him at the World Series. At the end of the first day, he was a chip leader with about 70,000 in chips. Now, the next day, they were supposed to come back, and they called me. Eric Drake was running the tournament at the time. Says, Stewie hadn't shown up. So I start calling, and so I called the Golden Nugget where I knew he was staying, and his room didn't answer. So I called security and had them go up to his room. Well, they found him laying on the floor beside the bed. They called paramedics, they put him in an ambulance, took him to Sunrise Hospital. So Eric called me back and says, well, they found Stewie. He was unconscious, and I went to, they took him to Sunrise Hospital. So I get in my car. I said, well, Eric, I said, can I come down there and play those chips? He said, no, you know you can't do that. He says, so anyway, I go to Sunrise Hospital. I go in, and evidently they didn't have a room yet because they got him sitting in the hall in almost like a bassinet. That's how small he was. He's a little bitty guy. Mm-hmm. And doing those drugs and everything, he'd almost shrunk up to nothing, really. So I go up there, and I see he's in there, and he's, like, asleep. So I shake him, you know, and he don't move. And a doctor, guy with the robe, comes up next to me and says, sir, says, do you know this guy? And I said, yeah, he's a friend of mine. He says, well, I says, he's in a poker tournament, and he needs to go play poker. He looked at me like I was crazy. He said, well, I got some bad news for you. He says, I gave him a little shot, and he's going to be out for quite a while. He's not going to be going back to that poker tournament. Uh-huh. I said, well, you think he'll be ready by tomorrow? He said, I have my doubts. So I go down there to the tournament. He had so many chips that he actually lasted into the – he barely got to the money in the tournament before they handed him off. Took him two and a half days to hand him off. And so that's when I was through with Stewie. No more nothing with you, no more Stewie. You got the chip lead, and you wind up in the hospital and don't even play for the money. So now a few years go by, and he was always in and out. And when he got money, he tried to play in the big game with us and everything. Let me say this about Stewie. He was a great no-limit hold'em player, but he was not a successful gambler. And also, he was the best gin rummy player that ever lived. And I don't think anybody's ever played anywhere like he played. He definitely was the best player, for sure.
So when he first came to town, you were a bit of a gin rummy player yourself, right?
I was.
Were you licking your chops when this young kid showed up?
No, I tell you, I wasn't exactly licking my chops, but these guys, they were two mob guys from New York brought him out here. I was at the Dunes, and they said, we got a kid who wants to play some gin rummy. Heard you play gin. So I said, yeah, I'll play. I said, where is he at? And then this little kid, he looked like he weighed about 85 pounds or something. Looked like he was about 12 years old. And so we went up to my room. This is before I ever moved out of the Dunes and bought Sid Wyman's condo. I'm just living there as a guest. And that's how early on that I met Stewie. And we go up to the room. He was so little. Back in the days, they used to have wooden Coca-Cola boxes. That's what the drinks come in. They put two Coca-Cola boxes in the chair for him to get up where he could get up to see the cards at the table. And naturally, he beat me out of $40,000, and I quit. And that's where I met Stu Unger. But anyway, going on from there, years later, after the experience with him not showing back up after having the chip lead after day one, he begging me, Billy, please let me, I'm clean now, I'm blah, blah. I said, Stu, please leave me alone. I'm trying to play poker. I'm playing a deuce to seven game down at the Horseshoe. And he just kept on days before the tournament was supposed to start. He kept coming every day. So he caught me one day when I was doing good. And he did look like he was pretty healthy at the time. I said, all right, Stu, I tell you what, I'm going to put you in the tournament, but if one time I ever catch you out of that chair, I'm going to kill you. Obviously, I was teasing about that, but that's what I said. I don't even know why I said that, but I said it. So he said, you do whatever you want to do. Just give me the $10,000. He said it in a little stronger language than that. So I put him in the tournament. Mike Sexton was babysitting him. He was in the room, going to the room with him every night, putting him to bed, this, that, and the other, and we had him clean as a whistle. So now, sure enough, he starts breezing through the tournament. That particular year, I got down to like the last 24 players, which was one of the first times I ever played the Hold'em. I didn't even ever play the tournament because, I boycotted Hold'em. And anyway, when he got down to like 24 players, he said, "You know, Billy," he said, "this thing's over with." He says, "there ain't nobody got a chance." And, of course, I got knocked out right along the end. I knocked Phil Hellmuth out that particular year right before I went out. And
was Phil a real good sport about you knocking him out?
Oh, it's funny you would ask that. I didn't want to say that. He got up out of his chair, says, "I can't believe this. People try to give me their money." He says, "I had a pair of tens next to the big blind. I was in the little blind. I opened with a pair of tens, and he moved in on me." And he says, "What did you think I had? Like these two tens or a piece of garbage or something?" You know, like he had two fives is what he had. But anyway, he ridiculed that hand. I mean, that just shows you he's completely unbalanced. But anyway, he ran it around for a while, and then he finally left the building. But no, he's going to do that. He can't help himself. But getting back to Stewie,
he's like Puggy in that way.
He went on and won the tournament easy. And I had half of them. First prize then was $1 million. We went over and we chopped up the million. And that was 3 or 4 months later, he was broke. And Mike Sexton drove him to my house. They wanting money. "Oh, Billy, please, he'll play good. I'll babysit him. I'll watch him, blah, blah, blah." So I said, "I'm not. Now, Stewie, this is the last money I'm ever." I gave him $25,000. They went to play in a game at the Bellagio. He goes over there. Mike called me about 3 hours later. And he said, "Well, we lost $14,000. He just got up and quit. He had $11,000 in front of him. And he just got up and quit all of a sudden. Said he didn't want to play no more." And that's when I knew right then that that boy was going to die. Because he never quit a game in his life if he had a dollar. And I just knew that was so unnatural for him to quit with $11,000. And sure enough, 3 weeks later, he was dead. Mm.
Do you still enter poker tournaments?
I play at the World Series about 3 tournaments out of about 50 or something. I've been playing the main event the last few years, and I play the No Limit Deuce and maybe one of the other low-ball events, and that's about it. It's too grand. It's like... You know, it's just too hard to do. You can go a day or so, but 3, 4, 5 days, it just grinds on you. And it's just, and that's why you see all these youngsters winning, because people talk about it. It's not anything athletic about it, but it's a strange thing. It got the table last year, if you looked at it, I think the guy was 21 that won it, but the oldest guy at the table was 33 or something. Maybe one guy was 40, I'm not sure. But there's no they make bets now that nobody over 40 will get to the final table. I mean, so age must mean something.
Yeah, it's an endurance contest. I mean, those are long days.
And they get longer and longer.
The skill level of the modern players compared to the skill level in the mid to late 70s when you played regularly with Doyle and Chip and
Sarge, Puggy.
Probably Johnny Moss was still
Johnny
playing
Moss,
that.
Yes.
So how is the skill level of the modern players compare?
Well, I'll tell you what I got to say about that. Doyle, believe it or not, and Doyle is one of the best players that ever lived, if not the best. He's a great player. He says that Johnny Moss was the best player he ever played with. He still says that today. I didn't have that experience because I came here a little late, and Doyle was from Texas and had been played on around Texas with Johnny 10 years or so before I came here, which makes Johnny go back 10 or 15 years with Doyle. My experience with Johnny was he became very predictable at the end, and he was an older guy, and he didn't play that good. So, but I know he had to be different earlier. So, but anyway, getting back to what the question is, Sarge Ferris was one of the most tenacious gamblers ever. Chip was a great player. Doyle was a great player. They all were really good players. How do they compare with the players today? I'll tell you how they compare. The guys that play tournaments, to me, is not even the same thing. It's like apples and oranges. In other words, in fact, a lot of them that are considered superstars are actually terrible at real money poker. In other words, they have no heart for real money poker. In other words, like they can take a $10,000 entry and put that up. They know that's all they can lose, and they play with conviction with that because they've learned that you have to. But if you sit them in a real poker game where people have 30, 40, 50,000 in front of them, and they're playing for that money, and they know if they lose, they got to reach in their ass pocket and take out some more money. They can't play at all. And I won't call the names, but there's some of these real popular names that fall way, way high up on the list of that, of superstar players that their money is not worth 10 cents on the dollar in the cash games. So having said that, it still doesn't exactly answer the question. They have taken poker to a different level. There's a lot of really good players now that can play. There's a lot of them that can play for the cash. The Ivies, and he's not the only one, but there's just a lot of them. This kid, Scott Seva, I think, is a great player. This kid, there's a new kid you might not even know of, Brian Tate. I predict him to be a real there's 40, 50, 60, hundreds of them that all play real good and are capable of playing cash games. But as a general rule across the board of all those hundreds of thousands of players, most of them don't play too good in mixed cash games.
Did you play on the Internet when the internet was popular? When
they came along, I wasn't crazy about the Internet because I always liked to play high-stakes poker. And to be honest, I didn't feel very comfortable playing on the Internet for big money. I mean, because it doesn't take any fool to know that if you're going to fix it to where people can cheat, they'll do it. And what's to stop, as everybody knows still, the three of us, we all playing at the same time. We're telling each other what we got, whatever. In other words, that's a big advantage. So, I never liked Internet poker. I think it's the greatest training tool that was ever invented, and that's why all these people play so good. They play so many hands so fast. They get good. They get good in a hurry.
All right. We've been talking to Billy Baxter. We've touched on a small number of the questions we have for him, so we're going to beg him to come back. Our guest next week will be Michael Shackelford, a former host of this show. And he's going to be talking about Super Bowl props. And hopefully he doesn't get burned on no safety again this year. That is a great bet. It's a cliff jumper. And something like four out of the last five Super Bowls, there's been a safety. And so Shaq still has hair. He hasn't pulled it all out. All right. Richard, if somebody wants to listen to our show, how do they do it?
You can reach us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. You can get the show delivered while you sleep. You can sign up to get it through YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, or at my website, richardmunchkin.com. You can listen to archives of all the old shows at bobdancer.com. You can also reach me on Twitter at RWM21. So send us your questions. You can send us your questions for Shackelford for next week about the Super Bowl and the prop bets. And that should do it. A lot of ways to find us.
All right. Thank you, Billy Baxter. Thank you, Richard Munchkin. See you next week. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.